This podcast is sponsored by Canaccord Genuity Wealth Management, award-winning wealth managers who go above and beyond to support and guide you. Visit candowealth.com to start building your wealth with confidence.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Cindy Yu and I'm joined by Katie Bors and the New Statesman's political editor, Stephen Bush. Katie, since we talked yesterday, there's been even more developments in the Greensill scandal with the reveal of Bill Crothers, a former civil servant who was involved. Can you talk about what's happened since then?
Yes, so I think what's really interesting with the story is, and it does sometimes happen to be the case, oftentimes the story will fizzle out. But I think in the case of the Greensill saga, almost every day your eyebrows are raised higher. So yesterday we had the desert camping photo, and now we have the revelation that there was a civil servant who had a job for Greensill while they were in government as a civil servant. And this appears to be in a loophole, which then meant when they left the civil service role, they did not need to get the Greensill role approved because they were already in that. So it's not as though you're trying to get a new job. Now, Eric Pickles, who now has a role here, has come out really yesterday with this. And again, it's given more life. And I think it's also done something which has suggested this is very institutional rather than just a Tory minister problem. So actually, it is now something which seems to be across the whole system. So it's not, I think, it's helpful to the Tory government, but I think but what I mean by that is, I think it's just showing the scale of this and how actually this is going to keep going in lots of different avenues. There are still lots of difficult questions for ministers potentially, but now I think the fact that there's talk of there could be more cases like this in the civil service, I think, has just given it another lease of life. And we saw today at Prime Minister's Questions the fact that Keir Starmer just went on this very hard, making it a party political attack line and saying, this is now a Tory sleaze, crisis.
Stephen, how effective is that attack line?
The limitation on pretty much all sleaze stories is that people just kind of think politicians are at it anyway, right? And I think a demonstration of that is found in the fact that Boris Johnson is the most popular leader the Conservatives have had since 2013, and his average approval rating is +7. Keir Starmer is the most popular leader the Labour Party have had since 2007, and his average approval rating is +2. So in general, I think these stories have quite a hard ceiling on their effectiveness, because you're just broadly saying, hey, you know those people you don't like, politicians, well, you're correct not to like them. But people already vote the way they do anyway. Where I think it is effective for Labour is kind of semi-coincidentally, which is, what was Boris Johnson's big political success in the autumn of 2019? It was basically turning a 9-year government into a brand new one, right? It embodied, the Conservatives were the change proposition in 2019. Now, that's partly, of course, because the Labour Party had shadow chancellor, same shadow home secretary, same leader as they'd had same shadow foreign secretary as they'd had 2 years prior. But also, he had a whole new team and he was able to make them seem new. And one of the things Keir Starmer has got right is he has continually tried to go, this is an old Conservative, this government's been in power for 10 years. And the weird thing is that although I think this story has become less personally dangerous to individual ministers now than it widened into this slightly farcical, oh, this person was doing two jobs, but they hadn't broken any rules, and in fact this had been signed off by other people, I think any day in which the Labour Party is able to say with a straight face, and we all report with a straight face, this idea that the Conservative government began in 2010 and will have been in office for more than 13 years at the time of the next election, even if it's a June 2023 one, is on balance a nice place for them to be in.
And that's by linking it to David Cameron's current links with the current ministers.
I mean, actually, in many ways, it is a very different government from the one David Cameron led, but was basically going, look, we're something completely different. Well, the one thing this story, at its heart, is the fact that these people all know each other. It's not actually that different in some ways. I think its differences are quite important, but it's not that different in some ways. And you can fairly go, this lot have been in power for more than 10 years. And I'm not saying that I think that whether or not people think the Tory government is new or old is going to be the whole of the next election, but I do think it's very easy for all of us in the bubble to underestimate the extent to which it is actually going to be quite a big part of the next election will be whether or not the Conservatives can go, we're still new, we're still renewed, we're still full of ideas, or if the Labour Party can go, guys, isn't it time for some fresh new faces?
Katie, it's not just in PMQs that Keir Starmer is going on the attack here. Labour has also tabled a motion to get a select committee to look into this sleaze scandal. It's failed. So what does that mean? Where does it go now?
We have an inquiry with questions over how much teeth it really has. I think what's interesting is you don't get a sense that Number 10 are particularly panicked by the Greensill saga. In fact, it seems an okay week for them. We're talking about one of Boris Johnson's former rivals in David Cameron. And I completely understand Stephen's argument. I've just been in a present now moment that they don't seem particularly worried. And then you obviously also have Rishi Sunak, who usually is above Boris Johnson in approval polls. He's being slightly dragged into it. And you have a situation where we have a lobbying a potential Tory sleaze scandal that doesn't involve Boris Johnson. And I think that's quite a, or doesn't yet, and I think that's quite a comfortable place for the Prime Minister to be. In a way, I think the fact that they have done this inquiry and the fact that you have a hardening towards David Cameron suggests that Number 10 do not think that the Prime Minister can or will be embroiled in this in any way, because otherwise I think you'd be treading a bit more carefully. I do wonder where we're going more generally, though, in terms of this lobbying. We had a story this week, which was in The Times, which was Eddie Lister, Boris Johnson's advisor, was due to go to Finsbury. He is now not doing that. But if that were happening, I think that row would be ticking along now, you know, bringing Boris Johnson in. But given lobbying is very, you don't want to say lobbying is endemic, because no one's saying it's lobbying itself is wrong, but given it's such a common practice, I am interested to see how long Downing Street can almost be in this high ground. It's questions from Matt Hancock. We know Rishi Sunak is facing questions from Labour, and ultimately there's also some in the sense of Labour questions. So how long until something happens, which questions what Boris Johnson has done or any of his team. I think it was interesting in Prime Minister's questions, the question that I think caught or made Boris Johnson seem the most surprised was when he was just directly asked in the backbench section, when was the last time he spoke to David Cameron? I don't know what you thought, Stephen, but he seemed slightly flummoxed by the question and then said, I can't remember when I last spoke to him. And then started talking about how when it came to this matter, there's nothing there. But I generally think when it comes to ministers, former politicians and potential lobbyists, it's not that comfortable ground for anyone if the rules are as murky as they are.
Yeah, exactly. Because, I mean, so one of the problems, I think, in British public life is that after the expenses scandal, which, yes, there were problems, but after the expenses scandal, there's very much been two problems that have been introduced in politics. One, MPs have never had enough staff, but now they don't have a large expenses budget to sort of make up for it, which means that their staff's critical faculties are outsourced to lobbyists stepping in and filling the gap. And also they have a deeply insecure job where they can, you know, one of the joys of election night is watching people essentially get their P45s in a gymnasium somewhere, where the sort of deal is, oh, well, don't worry, after you've left, you can go and earn lots of money lobbying your former colleagues. Indeed, that's also true for ministers who keep their jobs in as backbenchers, but who lose their ministerial salaries. Is, oh, well, you top it up in the private sector. And so I think any story which gets near to that is uncomfortable. Although, of course, there are many more Labour MPs who've lost their jobs in the last decade and had to move into the private sector. That is, of course, more acute if you're the governing party, because you're the people who actually have some access to offer. I think Katie's exactly right, though, that in many ways, from the narrow perspective of Downing Street self-interest, a corruption scandal involving someone with whom you are famously estranged, which is more awkward for probably your most dangerous internal rival, potentially your most dangerous rival, full stop. Because if Keir Starmer starts to succeed in damaging Boris Johnson, the obvious person who would be the agent of him being got rid of would actually be Rishi Sunak. Mm. So in some ways, this is not a bad week for Downing Street at the moment. But I do think it's one of those things where, as with expenses, this thread starts getting pulled. It opens a lot of questions, I think, lots of people have, and they'll kind of go, oh, wait, I thought you were a bit at it, but I didn't realise you were at it that much. And therefore, it's sort of dangerous for everyone, but it's more dangerous for the party in power, just as expenses, right? Lots of the most famous expenses scandals were actually Conservative MPs. But many more Labour MPs, because there were many more of them, had done it, and they were the government. They were therefore the ones with their hands at the wheel. And I think all of those dynamics are also true. But it is also such a technical story, which I think does help. And the return of normal news after the period of mourning, and one of the kind of weirdest things David Cameron has ever done, is choosing to release this statement at the time he did, which sort of guaranteed that he would have the spotlight for a week.
See, when you say that, you know, it's priced in, that some, we all know that this kind of revolving door kind of happens, but how significant is it that this revelation about a senior civil servant, who in his correspondence that's been revealed says it's not uncommon, the arrangement that he has with the private sector, how significant is that on an institutional level?
So I think the reason why it's significant is, I suspect one of the things that will change in British public life as a result of this is, it is my understanding that the Cabinet Office could not reliably say, oh, how many senior civil servants are on the board of charities? Mm. How many civil servants are on the advisory board of banks or fintech? I find it hard to imagine, because there will, of course, be select committee hearings. Labour will continue to these votes are always going to lose because government has a majority. But all of these votes are actually just an excuse for Labour to do their press release again, going, hey, guys, do you want to write about the fact there's a corruption scandal going on again? But I suspect the one change which I think I can't see how the government will avoid having to make is just a situation where every senior civil servant does have to have a register of interest, not least because I think that's pushing an open door for two reasons. We as journalists have to put interests arising from our parliamentary press passes. And MPs and peers have to put interests arising from their parliamentary passes. I think there's a lot of resentment, particularly among Conservative MPs who've been overlooked for jobs or have lost out on jobs. Then they have to make all of these declarations, yet the civil servants don't have to. And now, I think the vast majority of civil servants will not have questions to answer from that process. But I find it hard to see, as we go from a situation where at the moment there is no transparency, to one where there is as much transparency as there is for the Register of MPs' interests, then that won't create at least one set of awkward headlines for the government, let alone whether or not there'll be more. Not least because, you know, although Greensill is not an economically significant organisation in terms of the overall British economy, because we're still in this weird zone where the furlough still exists, very few people have lost their jobs directly, kind of the economy's still in semi-suspended animation. You don't need very many people to lose their jobs and to feel, whether they're correct or not, to feel like this is because of this story, for it to become one of those kind of sort of things that drains the life from day-to-day politics for a bit. So it is possible that, despite my personal kind of, isn't this all baked into the cake, that it becomes more painful for the government in the future.
Katie and Stephen, thanks very much, and we'll be bringing you all the twists and turns in the stories as they come. Do join us again tomorrow.